Thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source.
It's just a real pleasure to welcome Bob Hoy back to the studio today, formerly of Institutional Advisors, now Charts and Markets. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Yeah, good to be with you, Chris. Some excitement lately. You'll recall that last year we were looking at the probability of the discovery of a liquidity crisis in the fall. And if there was one, it could take until as late as Christmas to clear it. And that's indeed what happened. And I just looked it up the other day that on December 26th, our Chartworks came out and noted that both crude oil and the S&P were down into a sequential buy. So then the next thing is with the low accomplished, we thought it'd rally out till March, April, and be accompanied by a rally in industrial commodities such as base metals, crude oil, lumber, that sort of stuff, which we did get. And of course, crude oil, base metals peaked in March, and the crude oil continued on into April. So this was good stuff. It created the best four-month rally in early in the year in ages, if not the best ever. So we got the rally. And what we're looking at, Chris, is that this was obviously a seasonal move. So the next step is to put our technical analysis onto it so that you know that if you're getting excesses at the time you thought the market would be high, you know that most of the move is in. So and then in the last few weeks got a sharp correction. But it's the same old seasonal that quite likely positive things into April, May, maybe even to June. And then after August, you have the probability of things turning down. And this is your old sell in May and go away. And when you've seen these same forces all the way back for, well, if you were looking at great financial bubbles, stocks and things, there was the South Sea bubble in 1720. And then, which had its high in June and did it around in the summertime and then crashed in the fall. And then if you look back even further on prior to the time when there were equities and in the city-states in northern Italy, Florence, for example, there was an active market trading mortgages. And there was an incredible huge issuance of mortgages, and then it became illiquid, and then there was a crash. That was 1346, 1347 in there. And there's also a very lengthy and thoroughly scholarly book written on it by a writer by the name of Cipolla. At any rate, the worst moments in those contractions were realized in the fall. So that's the way we work. When it's time for a rally, we note it. And when it gets overbought, we note it. And then when it's time for the sell-off, which would be, let's say after August. And let's look at the things that would accompany this. You can have a seasonal high for crude oil late September. Last year it was October the 3rd. But more frequently and then quite regularly, you can have a seasonal low for crude oil in December, January. And the stock market goes up and down with crude oil. The other one is copper, for example. It can have a seasonal high somewhere between March and July, and then a seasonal low around November, December. Lumber is another important industrial commodity, and it can have a low in October. So these are forces that one doesn't want to defy. One wants to take advantage of them, and the way you do that is by having a reliable set of technical indicators that, in our case, we get. One model is, and it's based upon momentum and timing, and it gives an upside exhaustion, maybe a couple of weeks before you actually get to the high. And then there's another one, which is not proprietary. We got it from somebody else, and that is based upon pattern. And it gives, at a high, what we call a sequential sell, or at the low, a sequential buy. Then on the other one, with the upside exhaustion at a high, it'll also give you a downside capitulation. So now there are many people who try to buy a falling market. And as the old saying goes, it's like trying to catch a falling knife. So on, while as tempting as a declining market can be, our downside exhaustion model sort of reduces the harm that can be caused by trying to catch falling knives. So it's been working for a long time, Chris, and we really enjoy it. Our subscribers enjoy it. So what we're looking for here now is a trading range for all of, you know, stocks, junk bonds. Oh, here's one we should put in, the bond future. And when the stock market got heavy in the fall, the bond future started to rally as the counter trade. And then at the beginning of the year, we thought, well, maybe the bond future could rally out to May or June, and it has. But in the last few weeks, it's given a very strong, very exceptionally high readings. So it's very overbought. So, and also the reason for buying it was when the stock market got iffy, then it's sort of a flight to quality, i.e. the long end of the treasury market. But in history, when you get into serious problems, the flight is to short-dated instruments, T-bills. And this is what's now driving treasury bill rates down quite sharply. And with the long bond overbought, that's going to add some stress into the equation. So we're looking for bond prices to sell off, and we're looking for short-dated rates, like T-bill rates, anything shorter than 1 year, to be declining in yield. And this is really important, Chris, because part of the recent rally has been that the talk that the Fed is going to lower rates. Now, probably for every once in a while over the last 6 months, we were writing that what was missing for an important peak was the street to say, oh, the Federal Reserve will save us by cutting rates, and that will extend the boom. But I just did a piece on and included interest rates back to 1873, the 1873 bubble, and it's all there. T-bill rates go up in the boom, and yet when you've had rates up as recently, then the street starts worrying, oh, rates are high. But hey, if you just look at the evidence, short rates like T-bills go up in the boom, and as they are still going up, they confirm that the boom is on. You don't want to worry about anything until the T-bill rate turns down. So the six-month bill rate reached its high in December and has been really declining since March. At the three-month bill, which is more the action item, it reached its peak 6-7 weeks ago, and then I guess 2 weeks ago it broke down through the 20-week exponential moving average. So the T-bill rate is heading down similar to what it did in 2007 and similar to what it's done on every boom and bust cycle going back to at least 1873. So the evidence is very strong, Chris.
You took a look at the 1800 crash, 1873 you mentioned, and you found similarities between this pattern. And one of the key patterns is the sell in May and walk away, the adage from Wall Street that we all remember, but just seems to work so often, and there's been a lot of conjecture surrounding it. For instance, obviously people are more active in the warmer months. They're taking vacations, they're traveling, there's hotel accommodations, air flights, increased sales, and things of that nature. But for the most part, it seems to hold true. But I did want to get to something a bit more timely here. I'm sure you saw that the Fed head, Jerome Powell, last week gave us some surprising forward guidance. It really caught the markets a bit off guard. We saw at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the Fed funds futures collapse, giving us nearly a five-month increase in the likelihood or the probability of the rate cut cycle beginning as soon as next month at the next FOMC meeting. That's what the Fed funds futures implied probabilities are suggesting. Now, that's a sea change in sentiment by the investment and financial economic community, which were really not calling for any change or any budge in policymakers' Fed on the benchmark overnight lending rate stance until December/January. So with this big change, it's obviously inflationary, right? I mean, as rates start to decline, that means that the Fed's going to do everything it can to pump the economy. It sees some trouble.
The reason why a bill rate goes up in the boom is that there's demand by speculators for short-term money. Not just speculators, but businesses and everything else, and that shows up in the T-bill rate. And then comes the magic moment when the aggressive speculators slow down, and then you have the next magic moment when very careful money goes to the most liquid item, and that is treasury bills and the senior currency. It's much easier, Chris, to understand that the financial markets move the Fed. The Fed, everybody thinks that the Fed moves the financial markets. At times like this, like for example in 1929, and this latest market has had more of the classical characteristics of a great bubble than we saw in 2007. So there's more similarities to 1929 recently than any bubble since. So in 1929, the T-bill rate went up to May of 1929, headed down. And I have no idea why the Fed raised the discount rate in that August. But I know that there's a New York Times article on it from, I don't know, August 17th or something like that, 1929. And the Fed announced that its policy was it was going to tighten a little to Wall Street because it was speculative, but they had a way of easing to Main Street. So then the market took a hit, and then in October, the Fed lowered the discount rate. So it followed the market by, what, 5 or 6 months, and then similar on the 1873 bubble. So the history says that at the end of a great boom, the market rates of interest, like a T-bill, the one that trades all of the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sets the reversal, and then eventually the Fed follows. So our guess since March has been that the Fed would lower the its discount rate in September or October, or as they call it now, the Fed funds rate. So anyways, that's the administered rate. So to consider that the Fed is setting interest rate policy is not the full picture. If you look at evidence, the Fed follows market rates of interest. And my guess is on the next contraction, many of the public will begin to figure out that the Federal Reserve managing the economy has been a fraud and a farce all the way through anyway. So hey, let's just go back to the people who originally promoted the Federal Reserve system. And they correctly knew that a financial setback would lead a recession. It's the way business works. So then their theory was that with a Federal Reserve system, it could be the lender of last resort, and it would then prevent the financial setbacks that preceded recessions, so there'd be no recessions. And this goes back to, you know, while the Fed was formed in 1913, and this was one of the key motivations. But if you look at the NBER, which keeps track of the business cycle, there's been 18 recessions since the Fed opened its doors for business. Now, if you're a physicist, you'd say, hey, that theory doesn't work. But I think also on the next recession, with this popular uprising going on, the public is going to say, you guys spent trillions of our tax dollars to prevent a recession. And here we are in a recession. So, you know, that would be a year hence. You know, you have to wait till you get into it. But I think the next recession could greatly diminish the general regard for the Federal Reserve System and all of its manipulations and bogus theories and absolute nonsense. So I'm looking forward to it, Chris.
Clearly, Fed officials simply just did not reverse course on most of the QE, okay, from the quantitative easing, as they refer to it, which is essentially just good old-fashioned money printing, as they say. So now we still have, let's just say, more than $3 trillion remaining on the Fed's balance sheet. So we're in, you might say, something of a unique position here. For the first time that I can find, at least over the last 100 years of the Fed's tenure, at the helm of the world's largest economy, they did not have, let's say, the opportunity, or did not at least seize the opportunity, to curtail their QE operations, their money printing, and wring the excess liquidity from the system. And now we're facing the potential of another two quarters of back-to-back slowdown. We're on the cusp of what in the rearview mirror, seen in the rearview mirror, as the beginning of runaway inflation.
The pattern has been since early 1700s, where you have a huge global boom in commodities. And that peaked in 1711. And then there was the sharp crash and the deflation that followed. And then out of it came the South Sea Bubble, which was the first fantastic, huge stock mania. And traders and participants at that time just kind of invented the thing. Now, there had been bull and bear markets in London since the 1670s, when there were enough stocks being traded and enough traders to make a market. So at any rate, the first one, the South Sea Bubble, then blew out and was followed by a very harsh contraction. So then, decades later, you then had the same pattern go up, that and where you then had a global boom in commodities, a sharp contraction. Then, a decade later, the financial mania blew out, and that's the same thing right up to 1920, was the huge boom in commodities. And the crash was horrendous. Actually, in 1920, the U.S. rate of CPI inflation got up to 22%, whereas in 1980, it got up to, 15%. And people were sweating bricks about that one. But anyways, the pattern has been is that when you've had the big commodity boom, and then the next big commodity boom was in 2008, and that's when crude oil was up to 147, and a decade later, you have the big inflation in financial assets. So this is now the sixth time around for these paired events, the big commodity boom, big stock crash. So I'm just going to add a little more detail here, Chris. In the 1920s, the Fed was very concerned about weakening purchasing power because the commodity boom was over. So for the last decade, the Fed has been, following 2008, the Fed was concerned about weak purchasing power, only they phrased it that they had to keep the CPI inflation up at 2%, otherwise something bad will happen. So, again, to go back to the 1920s, the Fed was worried about poor pricing power, so they were exceptionally easy not understanding a stock bubble. So for the last decade, the Fed was exceptionally easy not understanding a stock bubble. So then on six such events, each one, once the stock boom was really over, was followed by deflation and everything. So the pattern has been inflation and tangible assets crash, inflation and financial assets crash, deflation and everything. So I don't have the imagination to suggest that this time it's different, that following a stock bust, you're going to go into a huge inflation and tangible assets. No, I'll stay with the old historical pattern.
Yeah, well, they say that history rhymes if we're looking between now and the 1920s and even 30s, simply because it was such a robust time. The economy, the nation as a whole, the manufacturing sector, and then as we came out of World War II, you know, we were the de facto global superpower. And I'm afraid that today, if we were still that manufacturing superpower, you know, we're barely holding on to number one against our largest trading partner, China. If we really still had that strength, why do we still have nearly $3.5, almost $4 trillion on the Fed's balance sheet? That, according to the St. Louis Fed's official tally, there. If we were in such good shape domestically, if this economy were so robust as our policymakers would have us think, then wouldn't it have been an easy play just to soak up and wring that excess liquidity out of the system? But now we're in a position where all we can think to do is prepare to heap even further money onto that enormous debt load. And we may look back at this as the beginning of the end as far as global inflation is concerned. So as we wrap up, do you have any other comments on the precious metals? I mean, obviously, we've had a nice run up here in the past few weeks, and U.S. stocks turned around as well.
Precious metals, it's a fantastic sector. And again, I'm going to recite the history on this, is that in order to understand gold, you have to deflate the price by the CPI in the senior currency. Well, so beginning in 1700, of course, sterling was the currency, and there's a pattern, and it worked this time, that in the final stages of a great financial bubble, gold's real price comes down, and it's been coming down since 2011, and it makes the gold sector, gold stocks, underperformers relative to Dow Jones Industrials.
I would request that you might step back for just one moment at the bigger picture and note that the price of gold and silver and related commodities, not necessarily on a real basis, but in comparison, the real U.S. share prices from a nominal basis, yes, U.S. shares have had a phenomenal run, but on a real basis, the NASDAQ is only approaching break even here, whereas the precious metals are still sharply higher, even on a real basis, from the year 2000 peak. If we look just at the competing asset classes as complementary goods, then I think it gives us a slightly more positive view of the precious metals.
The next stage of what I was working on is that when the real price of gold sets its low as the stock bubble is ending, then each of these, well, four out of five examples were followed by a 20-year bull market in gold's real price and a 20-year bull market for gold stocks. Of course, there'd be interruptions, would be the ordinary business cycle, you know, the 3 or 4 year business cycle. So the gold bugs of today are all on the inflation story, But they would be well advised to take a look at financial history and realize that some of the greatest bull markets for gold and gold stocks have occurred in post-bubble deflationary contractions. And we had the real price of gold come down with the latest bubble. We had the gold stocks underperforming the S&P during the bubble. The other one that is also historical is that real prices of base metals such as copper, well, they go up in the bubble and then down in the long deflation afterward. That's where how gold outperforms everything else. And for this, well, the last 6 or 7 years, gold deflated has been doing what it does in a bubble. And it is basing here now, which I'm enthused about. And I quite expect that during the post-bubble contraction, the gold's real price will go up. And as it goes up, it improves the profit margins for gold mining. It's Mother Nature's way of reliquefying a crazy credit system when you're in a credit contraction. If the real price of gold goes up, it gets into the banking system. So when you've got normal and fanciful instruments of credit contracting in a bust, you got the real price of gold going up, which starts to reliquefy the system. And this has been doing it, Chris, for 300 years relative to stocks. So I'm very convinced that we will have a great bull market for gold stocks, but it won't be due to the old-fashioned idea of inflation. It'll be due to gold's real price going up, as it did in the 1930s, as it did in the 1880s, and all the way back. It's quite regular. For example, the greatest gold rushes have been like California and Australia in the 1840s. Well, that was at the bottom of of that depression when the real price was high and unemployment was high. So you had unemployed young men looking for something to do, and they would have a gold rush. And then that repeated in the 1895 gold rush in the Klondike. So even the gold rushes have occurred towards the end of a Great Depression. So financial history, when you lay it all out, is really remarkably regular. So I'm looking for a bull market in gold stocks, history, based strictly on history.
Very good. Well, you know, that's going to be music to the ears of our listeners today. Okay, Bob Hoy, as we wrap up, if you could tell people a bit more about bobhoy.com, all the great material they'll find when they bookmark your website and log in.
Yep, they can do that. It's just bobhoy.com. And also, even if you just Google Bob Hoy, that B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, there's all kinds of old articles and papers and stuff floating around. So this story that I've just given you on gold, it's published in a number of places over the last decade or so. Actually, I've been working on it since about 1980, so it's been fascinating.
All right. Thank you so much, Bob Hoy.
Good, Chris, and look forward to talking to you next time.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Apmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technologies.
vault chain.
Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs.
As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums.
OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click.
Vault Chain
offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
Gold Seek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Shopping for fine jewelry just got easier. GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Many Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share, with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Many Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Many Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Many Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange and in the US, MENEF. Remember to sign up to Many's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Many Jewelry.
Gold Seek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.